Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski of the Professor Is In.
And I am Kel Weinhold, also of the Professor Is In.
And we would like to thank our sponsors, which is you. If you are listening, you can potentially become a supporter of the Professor Is In podcast for $3.99 a month by going to bit.ly/ourpod, bit.ly/OURPOD. And we thank you for that.
Then you get to talk to us in a little private area and ask all sorts of questions. We are carrying on our conversation, and we mentioned it at the end of the podcast last week, and I sent a missive out into the universe saying that I had discovered the work of Dr. Aaron Seck. I gave all sorts of pronunciations last week just to make sure I covered them all. But Dr. Aaron Seck and her work about, in particular, her upcoming book on passion in the workplace. And so she is joining us today. And I'm so excited about that.
I know. I am too. You know how I feel about the word passion.
I do know how you feel about the word.
Everybody knows how I feel about the word. I don't know. Anyone who's read my book knows how I feel about the word passion. It is literally, we call it the P word.
Yeah.
Like, do not use that word in our presence. At the Professor Is In. So you, as the author of the upcoming book, The Trouble with Passion, coming out with University of California Press, you're the expert.
So give us a little bit of an intro so our listeners know about what you want them to know about you.
Absolutely. So I am an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. I have a joint appointment in the mechanical engineering department as well. And I have been researching cultural mechanisms of inequality reproduction for nearly a decade now, certainly through graduate school and beyond. And the things that really fascinate me are the kinds of cultural beliefs and practices that seem objective or neutral on their surface, but can be incredibly powerful forces reproducing inequality because we don't seek to look at them. They seem like they're just fine or they're really good. And so we don't take the time to really dig under the surface. And the passion principle is certainly one of those ideas.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, I could talk for the next 30 minutes.
But we didn't invite you on to talk. Thank you very much, but you're not invited today.
Right. So tell us, what made you start studying or decide to focus the book on passion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I wouldn't have written a book on passion had it not hit me upside the head in the data. I have been a long follower of the idea of pursuing your passion. I left a very standard route in engineering to follow my passion in sociology. I was an evangelizer of the idea of following your passion until I started working on this project. And I started interviewing undergraduate students about why they were interested in, why they were choosing the majors that they were choosing, and what about those majors led them to that decision. And I kept hearing this narrative over and over and over again. I'm following my passion. I want to do what I love. I'm willing to sacrifice a really good salary or job security if I can do what I love. And that really led me to want to understand what this thing was. So I did interviews with 100 undergraduates at 3 different universities, followed some of those after they graduated, and then did a survey of thousands of college-educated workers in the United States to see if the passion principle was something that they bought into. And so I tried to take this idea of the passion principle and walk around it with as many different methodologies and data sources as I could to be able to really understand it at a deeper level.
That's amazing. And so, cutting to the chase, how does passion reproduce inequality?
It does it in a couple of ways. So first and foremost, it does so by leading people to make decisions about their career paths in ways that prioritize passion seeking. But not everybody has the same springboards and safety nets to be able to parlay their passion into gainful employment, right? There's a ton of literature on what it means to be able to find one's footing in the labor market. And it takes all sorts of connections and resources to do that successfully. And so many career aspirants will see passion as a way to move forward in their career decision making, in part because they see it as a way to orient themselves to a labor market that doesn't necessarily look so good to them. Mm-hmm. So they're very aware of the kind of precarity and overwork that exists and burnout that exists in especially the white collar labor force, and they are not excited to join it. And so they see finding work that they're passionate about as almost an inoculation against the potential drudgery of that, and also as a way to not make the overwork feel so much like overwork. And so in doing so, at the individual level, career decision makers not only might make decisions that make it difficult for them to find stable footing in the labor market, but also put themselves in a position with paid work that really amplifies their own exploitation. Ah. And I talk about this in the book as a way that finding yourself in the work that you do is a really interesting way of giving your employer labor that they're not necessarily rewarding you for and paying you for. So that's one side, the kind of individual level decision-making side. But on a broader level, at the more aggregate level, it reproduces inequality first and foremost by being what I call a narrative of choice washing. So passion is this narrative, not only that we have about how we make career decisions on our own, but how other people should and do make career decisions in the wider world, especially if you have a college degree. And so if I am looking out in the labor, at the labor force and seeing these kinds of differences in access to healthcare, access to good wages, access to a profession that is highly respected in the world, and I have a vision that people make decisions on the basis of their passion, on the basis of things they're interested in, that choice washes those inequalities. It explains them away as something that is not requiring of remediation. And so I do a lot of analyses where I'm looking at the connection between people's adherence to the idea of the passion principle and their belief that, for example, gender inequality can be overcome just by working hard, or income inequality can be overcome by those things. So this passion principle does cultural work in the social world that reproduces
excusing inequality.
Making
equality look natural and defensible.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to go back to the first part and drop in where I see the passion principle at work in the academy, because, you know, we're all about the academy. And to me, that lands squarely in adjunct work. And it lands squarely in this idea of, so what you were talking about, sort of giving your employer more than they're paying for, and somehow this idea that with the love of it and your devotion to it, it will bend to your will. And so can you talk a little bit about how you, you know, sort of turn the lens of the passion principle to academia, both at the people choosing to come in, but really at that adjunct level? I'm fascinated by.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think nowhere is the potency and the problematicness of the passion principle more salient than in the issue of adjunct work. And part of that is the way that we in academia, I think across disciplines, define excellence in a particular discipline is being passionate about it. You're passionate about history, you're passionate about sociology or chemistry or what have you. And that passion is going to carry you through graduate school and carry you through the trials and tribulations of the labor market. And so to not embody that passion, not to have that passion and express that passion, is in some ways to not be as good as other people might be at the content of the work. Although that in of itself is, you know, a complete misnomer. Those things are not actually connected, but yet we see people's passion for the work as part of their expertise. And so when it comes down to people being able to stay in academia, the expectation is, well, why wouldn't you want to stay in academia if you could, even if that means a precarious position, a temporary position? You're still in academia, aren't you? You're still fulfilling your passion, aren't you? So this sense that being people being able to do work that they're passionate about is in some ways its own compensation, I think, is a very strong undercurrent of the way that adjunct faculty are treated.
And it's why it's so hard for them to come out of the, to challenge their own belief system or to properly recognize the exploitation. I don't know that that's true. I think people do properly recognize the exploitation. I guess they just, it's very difficult to come to envision an alternative.
Right.
Because nothing else would seem to promise the passion reward.
Exactly. And if you were in a position where the expectation is that adjuncts are in a position where they are doing this work because they're passionate about it, for that person then to go to the department chair and try and negotiate for more salary or more resources seems to fly in the face of the very idea that they're committed to the work in the first place. And so it's a very challenging position, I think, for people to be in that space.
And this is, that leads into sort of where I was going to go next, because as a productivity coach, one of the things that I work on with people a lot is to set boundaries and to make the job be a job, like not a life's work, but a job, and that it is capitalism, as much as the academy would like to pretend that it isn't. It is in fact capitalism. So I'm really fascinated by exactly what you're talking about there, which is setting a boundary, setting a limit, asking for more, focusing on financial well-being, that those somehow are make you less than as a scholar, either working like saying, no, I work a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job. That's what I do. There's so much self-judgment and judgment about that. We hear PIs say to people in labs all the time, you need to be here all the time.
If you're not working 80 hours a week, you don't have what it takes to be a scientist.
To be in this job, that sort of thing. So what's your research show about that? Or what's your take on that whole vibe?
Yeah. So I want to step back for a second and talk a little bit about where this passion principle comes from, this is really sort of a salient thing, and why, particularly in academia, it's so powerful. So the reason that the passion principle is such a powerful idea about sort of career decision making and the way that people orient themselves to their work has to do with decades of the erosion of worker power and the ability for people to have long-term steady jobs that made sense to them. And that is sort of that in combination with the astronomical rise of expectations for self-expression really interwove this idea that in order for us to manage this uncertain labor market, we might as well just do something that we love if no one is going to have stable work for us. And so it's in this moment that in sort of this postmodern, post-industrial societies where there's this expectation that we find what Anthony Giddens calls the reflexive project of the self. Mm. And this is the thing that we are supposed to center our lives around and trying to understand who we are and what our purpose is in the world. And what happens is the passion principle provides a really convenient answer to this question of who we are supposed to be. And it allows us to have this vector that is clearly laid out for us institutionally, that culturally has a lot of resonance. And so we come to define ourselves and seek lifelong fulfillment in the pursuit of our passion. And nowhere is that more potent than in academia. And there's often conversations about people considering graduate school. Only go to graduate school if you're passionate about it.
Absolutely.
Because if you're not, you're not going to survive. Mm-hmm. And so they're socialized to be so committed, not only committed to working hard, but committed as part of their identity.
Right.
That to be able to move through that work and have a sense of self that exists outside of one's occupation, one's profession, becomes harder and harder to do.
Right.
And I'll say one last point in relation to that is that when we have such overwork, especially in academia, whether it's people who are ladder rank faculty or adjuncts or even graduate students and postdocs, this expectation that they're working longer and longer hours, not only does that lead to sort of overwork and burnout, but it leads to less and less opportunities for them to find space, to find meaning outside of that. Mm. And especially for graduate students, if they're working in the lab for 80 or 90 hours a week, they can't find that place outside of work as readily for who they are. And if academia is not for them, if they stumble or they realize this is not the path they want to take, I think it becomes especially hard to come out of academia and say, who am I?
Right.
What is who am I outside of this context of my profession?
Yeah. I think that you've just given a fantastic kind of elaboration of why I have always wanted to call academia a cult-like environment, if not a cult, because it doesn't technically reach that threshold, but a cult-like environment. And that's why, is because the deeper you go in and the more you accept these judgments and standards of workload and so on, the less time you have. I mean, it's almost just a pragmatic issue. There's no time to think about doing something else.
Right. I had never, okay, I have just have to like have one of those emoji things over my head, like the mind blown emoji, because I talk to people a lot about taking weekends off, finding other things to do, blah, 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 blah. And I usually have to start really small. Well, I always say take weekends off, but that overwhelms a vast majority of people. And I hadn't really thought about, and I've come at it from the other side of, what did you do before graduate school? What have you forgotten that you enjoy? But I hadn't really ever thought of graduate school as the structural or as the machine that basically eliminates external meaning. The machine says
external meaning.
There is no meaning outside of this space, so don't pursue it. Mm-hmm. And the true anxiety, I was talking to a senior scholar today, full professor, white male, who is working on taking weekends off and admits that the first half of Saturday is mostly just spent in panic of working on his anxiety of what am I supposed to be? What's the point of this? What am I supposed to be doing? And that idea of the system actually eliminating the meaning of everything outside of it, that kind of just, that blows me away.
It's really valuable. Going to influence how I talk about this from now on. I too, in my settings, talk about this incessantly.
Right.
So I have a question that I want to ask you. I first began to find language to problematize passion and love, do what you love, DWYL discourse, from reading Mia Tokumitsu in 2015 and her Jacobin piece, and then she wrote a book. And then I just recently on Twitter saw Sarah Jaffe has a book called Work Won't Love You Back. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it is sitting on my coffee table. Anyway, I'm just interested to hear, how does your work intersect with some of the other books that have come out about this, the pitfalls of passion?
Sure. I mean, this is such a giant space. I think there's room for all of us and much more. The front half of the book are taking seriously this idea of the passion principle as a cultural schema and defining what that means, not only how prevalent it is, but why people find it so compelling, what it is about about passion that attaches them to it, not only individually, but structurally and culturally, what it is about the post-industrial societies that people live in that lead to passion being this seeming solution to inoculate them from the drudgery of the paid workforce. And then I take it from there to really think about the way that it reproduces inequality. So I talked a little bit about that briefly before, but the way that they do this in part is to say, what happens when college graduates from different socioeconomic backgrounds try to follow their passion? What happens to them? And so typically what happens is that people with lots of springboards and safety nets are able to launch into the things that they're passionate about, regardless of really what their major was mm-hmm. in college. And people who don't have those kinds of resources really struggle to find their footing and their passion. And they're the ones who end up in jobs that might be really precarious in their passion or really far outside their passion and really unstable or even unemployed. So it's this kind of way of reproducing the class inequality that students came in with under the guise of them making these kind of career decisions down the line. Mm. And then toward the end of the book, I actually utilized some experimental data to look at how potential employers view people who are applying for jobs, whether they express that they're passionate about the job or they're interested in it for other reasons, like they like the organization or they like the location. And what I find is that people looking at applications that are where people are expressing their passion for their work are really excited about those applicants and want to hire them more than people who see applicants who express other reasons for being interested in their jobs, in part because they think passionate workers will work harder, will put in more effort beyond what's required of their job, but they don't offer them any higher salaries. They don't reward them for that. So the kind of conclusion of the book is pulling all these things together, the more kind of social psychological pieces, along with the structural and cultural pieces, which is of course sort of emanating from my training and expertise as a sociologist, to make an argument not only about the passion principle as a career decision-making mantra, which is really, I think, the centerpiece of the work that sort of exists in the literature space on this, but really as this cultural mechanism mm-hmm. of inequality and of social differentiation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a little bit of a shift here, or maybe not actually. You mentioned in part of the book that sort of the conversation about individual agency versus the, basically the structural constraints, right? So there's this whole narrative of individual agency in here in this passion principle. And if we switch back to the academy, there's this sense for so many people going in that they have this idea of individual agency. I can go in here, I can study this, then I'll, and then they come out the other side and the structural constraints.
It's a de-agentification process.
Right. It's like, no. And then what I see is the pain that what we deal with a lot is the pain of that acceptance. Because there tends to be a lot of sort of spinning your wheels in the mud, still thinking that your individual agency will solve it.
And therefore it's your individual failure that you didn't.
It's your individual failure that you didn't, right? Yeah. I also have just a little aside thinking about the structural, the sort of economic inequality and people who gather a great amount of debt mm-hmm. to have this passion mm-hmm. and the people who don't.
Right.
And then where they each end up, which ties to the availability of the job at the end.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we say all the time is, unlike virtually any other profession, you can't do your job. You can't be a professor on your own.
A lawyer can open up, it may not be a very prestigious route, but they can practice law on their own. A doctor, it may be pretty precarious and difficult, but they can be a concierge doctor. In fact, we go to one, who has a little house and runs an office out of a house. But a professor cannot be a professor without a university.
Which means, well, now I'm going to go off on the autonomy thing and the burnout thing. And we're doing an amazing job of not digressing here. You're probably the only person who's kept us so far from our typical digressions. But I'm really interested in that. Like, what do you say as the sort of, I guess I want sort of bracing cold water that says individual agency, not a thing. So how do you put that together with passion?
Well, passion, passion principle contributes, as I said, to this choice washing process about agency. So right. It says that if you have enough passion, you can do anything, right? And there are these sort of celebrated examples of, I mean, like Elon Musk, right? He had passion. Of course he could do anything, but you know, his sort of resources and privileges are beside the point in that. And I think what's so interesting in moments where in my data, I found that people hit a structural wall in that they couldn't go far because they didn't have the resources, they didn't have the training that was on par with their peers. They would often blame themselves in exactly the way that you're talking about, Cal. And I think what the emotional difficulty and cognitive difficulty that's there is not just the feeling of I've failed to enact my agency and try hard enough in this space to succeed. But if you're passionate about it and you can't succeed in it, and you anchor such an important part of your identity in that profession, it's a threat to your sense of self.
Yeah, right.
And that's scary. That's mm-hmm. so hard to have that rug be pulled out from under you, mm-hmm. as well as the one about you being competent and able mm-hmm. To be able to do the work in the way that you want.
I think about that so much because people who go into the PhD program are often the nerdy kids. I was certainly one of them who, instead of, you know, out playing softball, we're in the library, we're reading, and we discover the existence of the academy at some point in our lives and feel that we found salvation, you know, so, and safety and acceptance and all those things that humans are always looking for. And then, you know, it's the identity. And I think that feeds into the almost impossibility of imagining something else, because it's like, but no, this was the one thing that was going to save me. Mm-hmm. And now I can't have it.
So if you had to give advice to people currently starting off in the PhD, so let's start there, because like you said, it's a ladder process, right? You're at a different stage in it. So you're in your first or second year of your PhD, or these people, and we see them on Twitter right now because this is when all the acceptances are coming. I'm so excited to start the graduate school. And we're like,
yeah, you're on Twitter, right? You're pretty active there. You see it too, right?
I do. Absolutely.
Oh, it's so distressing.
Right. So if you wanted to give them a sort of path to follow, to decouple, to follow this thing they love, but decouple it from this idea of the passion principle. What's the path here? Because I see it trapped, I see it super trapped in capitalism and what's being used to keep us working. And I'm a serious cynic about this. So how do we save them? or at least give them something to follow that they might save themselves. I know we can't do it, but like, what's the answer?
But how do you break through the fantasy? Because passion, this whole passion principle, it's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. So people are not going to welcome you. They're not happy to see you coming and saying, guess what? Let me give you some facts and figures about the actual state of indebtedness for graduate students, and also the 3% of people who get jobs. And they'll be like, well, I'll be one of the 3% because I'm passionate. And it's like, oh my God. So what do you do?
Exactly. I would say that there are a few things to keep in mind. First and foremost, to think as pragmatically as possible in the very beginning stages of graduate school about what you're in it for. So graduate school is this place where we're supposed to nurture and advance our passion, but in the end, it's a certification procedure. You get this thing that is supposed to give you access to a different kind of job. And so you have to start thinking about what the labor market looks like with that degree and what you want your career to look like, at least in this stage immediately after having this certification. And if it occurs to you that what you want to do with your career doesn't require the PhD, doesn't need you to walk through that process, that is a really important set of considerations for you to say, do I want to stay in this path? Does it make sense for me to stay in this path? What am I gaining and what am I giving up for this context? Second, I think it's really important to, as I say, diversify your meaning-making portfolio to find, to use like an incredibly economistic, unusually economistic
phrase. That is awesome. Wait, say that one more time for the people in the back.
Diversify your meaning-making portfolio.
Awesome. Yeah.
I say that ironically, of course, because I'm talking about the kind of difficulties of the passion principle and the way that it reproduces exploitation and capitalism. But I mean the sentiment of it that we need to be able to find places early and often outside of our paid work, outside of our graduate school path, that we find meaning in, that makes us feel joy and excitement and identity, because there are times when that career path is not going to be there for you like that. And we all need a place to find meaning outside of that. I struggle with that still. Well, and it was something that was really hard for me to think about as I was writing this book. I am fully passionate about sociology. I was really busy as a graduate school student and an assistant professor, and I didn't have time to do other things that I find joy in. And so I'm really now trying to find those spaces. So making sure to make space in one's life for those other meaning-making spaces is important. And, you know, thinking about how graduate students contribute to and reproduce the passion principle among maybe the undergraduates that they might work with, making sure that they are committed to meeting students where they are in terms of what the students want for their career path after getting their undergraduate degree, and making sure not to shame or try and talk students out of a different path. And along with that, maybe for the graduate students and for the undergraduates that they work with, finding concrete tools that are outside of their field of study. So anthropology majors taking coding classes, or people who are doing chemistry taking technical writing courses, things like that, to kind of give oneself a little bit more breadth in tool and task. And the final thing I'll say is to make sure, regardless of where graduate students are in their career path and where they go, that they understand that they are responsible for contributing to the collective action to pressure policymakers and administrators and faculty to make things better for people who have jobs that are far outside their ability to find passion in mm-hmm. them. That really this is the solution to the challenges of the passion principle in academia and beyond are not looking inward, but looking outward and looking for collective opportunities to bring more stability and more security to everyone in the labor market.
Mm-hmm. Amen to that.
Seems like a good place to
stop. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Erin. That was brilliant and so insightful for our listeners, for us, for anyone in the academy of any, you know, status there. So thank you. And when is your book coming out?
It's coming out in the fall. If you go onto my website, which is erinastack.com, I have a sign up there and I'll notify you when it is out in print.
Wonderful.
That is outstanding. Well, thank you very much. One last note here. This podcast is made possible every week by the exceptional work of our editor and producer, Stephanie Blair. If you happen to need audio visual work, be sure you go check out baddieblair.com, BaddieBlair.com. And also, I encourage you to check out her phenomenal home decor and apparel designs. And you can check those out at chochochen.com, chochochen.com. As always, Stephanie Blair, we are grateful for your incredible talent. Thank you.